Turning our attention now to the weather. It's the last Monday of the month. That means the weather guys, Steve Ackerman, John Martin, join us. Steve is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, also a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
Steve, good to see you, too.
It's good to be here.
And I tell you what, we've got lots of things we can talk about. There was a report of water spouts, a huge number of water spouts on Lake Michigan this weekend. What are those? And those can be dangerous, can't they?
They tend not to be dangerous. I wouldn't want to run into one in a rowboat.
Right. Put it that way. I wouldn't row into one.
Yeah, you don't go looking for them, but I think you can fairly safely watch them from the shore or even from on deck if you're far enough away on the water. They're not usually very dangerous. They're effectively dust devils, maybe a little more intense than a dust devil. And the ones on the weekend probably were a result of the fact that the air about a mile or so above the ground is very, very much colder than the water temperature. And so it was the first example of significant lake extraction of heat from the lake. And sometimes with the strong easterly wind we had, that's enough to kick up these little devils of steam, and they have the water spout look.
And they look very ominous and very threatening. But even the weakest tornado is a lot stronger.
Right.
Okay, so it's not spots. I think people were told that if they came on land, that people should seek shelter and
it might not be a bad idea just to get out from underneath a tree. A branch might get blown down on you or something. But even that's probably extreme for a water spout. They're pretty weak.
I think the greatest danger would probably be like something like hypothermia.
Yeah, maybe that's right. Yeah,
you'd get really low pressure in there. You get cold really quick.
All right. Well,
but I wouldn't go walk. Don't say the weather guy said you could walk into one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that would be a gross misconstruction of what we just said.
Well, I tell you what. Let's let me give the number. If you have a weather-related, weather or climate-related question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a photo there or ask a question. And Catherine has posted on the Facebook page a photo, and you should really go to the page to see this. What is the sight that they saw? It was a rainbow in the top of the sky that appeared to form somewhat of a circle. It looks like an upside-down rainbow.
It looks like an upside-down rainbow.
Fairly clear skies.
Yep, and it looks like the sun is below it.
It was 5 p.m.
And it's 5 p.m., so the sun is below it. It's up high. It's like the same colors of a rainbow, except it's reversed. So instead of the rainbow being bowed, this is more like a U. And we call this an upper tangent arc. And it's generated by ice crystals up in the atmosphere. Oh. And there's not a lot of ice crystals. And that's why if you look at the picture, you'll see the sky behind it is very blue. And it's very much like those prisms you hang up in your window.
Yeah.
When the sun comes in and generates it, it's the same type of thing. The light hits it and bounces off it and comes your way. I've only seen this like twice, so it's not a very common optical phenomena, and that's really a nice picture.
She got a great photo of it.
It is fantastic. I bet it was even more stunning live, as often the case with these optical phenomena. That's a really good
picture. I may actually try and put that in our book, so I may email her back and say, Catherine, could we use this?
That's a really good example.
Very
well done picture.
Very good example. Well, we had a question from someone about the Boundary Waters fires. How did it affect... And this is Boundary Waters fires in Minnesota, but it had some effect on air quality.
For way, way down as far as south of Chicago. We wrote about this in our Monday column in the Wisconsin State Journal a couple of weeks ago. Those fires actually began in the middle of August, and then they were really exacerbated by the winds and the subsequent dryness after that period of time, and then winds with a particular storm that came through and got us cooler here in the middle of September. But they closed the roof at Miller Park that night, 500 miles to the south, and there was ball games in Chicago that same night. I don't know if it was at Comiskey or at Wrigley, but there was a serious air quality issue and a plume that went right down the central part of the state and headed towards the southeast part towards Chicago. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Al in Kakana has a comment or a question for you guys, so let's go to Al. Hi, Al.
Hi. Hey, I'm a truck driver, and I was up in Minnesota last week, and I was talking to a guy, and he mentioned to me that we should be getting a snowstorm pretty soon. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, he said, 6 months after the first thunderstorm is usually the first snowstorm. Is there any, you know, does that make sense?
Well, it makes gross sense. You know, we don't usually get thunderstorms at a, you know, in any sort of high frequency until about June, maybe late May, around here, and then that'll vary a little bit with latitude, I suppose. And then
he said this year the first thunderstorm was like March 23rd or March 26th.
Yeah,
like
that. See, that's the kind that you really shouldn't count that one if you're going to use this rule, because I think the rule really isn't significant. That's what I was getting at. That, you know, if you know your summertime convective weather season starts in late May. And then our snow season starts in late November, so that might be where this rule actually came from. And then the occasional stray thunderstorm that arrives in, you know, February, March, or April can throw it off a little bit. So I'd say that your almost certain quizzical look when he said that, Al, was absolutely on target. Yeah. There's no real risk of snow in the next week or so.
In fact, if you see him again, you should say that, you know, well, after the first snowfall, 7 months from now, it'll be hot.
Yeah, right.
Thanks, Al. Thanks a lot for calling. It's a good one. I like that. Ron in Norwalk, your turn. Hi, Ron. Ron, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. I live in the Driftless region of Wisconsin.
Okay.
And one of the things I noticed after a rainfall, not today, it's kind of cold and wet here, but like during the summer months after rainfall, I look out in our trees and I see these columns of fog kind of coming up through the trees. Huh. But it's not, you know, the whole woods. It's just certain areas within the trees that are coming up. And I was wondering what's causing that, if that's meteorological or if it's something botanical or with the trees or something. But I'm not sure. Have you ever seen that phenomenon?
What it reminds me of is the Blue Ridge Mountains. You know, a lot of times after it rains there, or if it's humid, you see fogs coming out of the trees there.
And
and it sounds like biology may play a role in the sense that, you know, trees give off a lot of, particularly certain types of trees, give off a lot of aerosols or tiny little particles, terpenes, like turpentine. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but and so those tiny little particles can act like condensation nuclei, where water vapor can condense onto it and generate little fog particles.
Oh.
And so if you have, after rain, you know, the air is going to be humid, and, you know, with those small particles, maybe a little solar heating can, or a little upslope on a hill can get that air moving above the forest and see those, like, smoke almost coming out of the forest.
Yes, that's exactly.
Yeah, I have seen this before, and I've often wondered about it. I think sometimes it can also be you have local cool spots in the forest, and until or unless it rains, the air doesn't get close enough to saturation for them to actually sustain, you know, that cloud after the rain's over. There's a little bit of condensation still in the air right near the ground. A really great example of this is at the base of those granite cliffs at Devil's Lake State Park. If you go through some of the paths on the bottom of the cliffs, there are certain locations, they've actually carved them out for you to walk into them. We went on July 1st. It was a really hot day. Temperature was over 90. But these things, it was like you were in a produce chest. There was so much refrigeration coming out of there because the underside of the rock is so cool. And then the air just falls down the side of the mountain, protected from the sunshine. And you have really cold spots. Had it rained earlier in the day, I'm sure there would have been fog hanging around in those spots because of the low temperature.
Very cool.
It is cool.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Nick in Green Bay. Let's go to you now. Hi, Nick.
I've got a question for you real quick. I love weather, so this was awesome. I had an experience last month. We had a really nasty storm that came through. It took down trees and stuff. But about 15 minutes after the storm, I drive a bus. So with a nice, huge, like, conductive metal lift. And there's a cloud to ground lightning. And, I mean, it was close enough. I never knew that lightning was, like, blue. But this is blue, and you can actually see it pulsating.
Oh, wow.
And it seemed like it took forever for the boom to come. I mean, I actually thought it's going to be really loud. And I could actually think that. And I know you can't tell me, like, complete distances, but, I mean, it was really loud. It was like looking into a 100-watt light bulb. I was wondering if you could tell me how close you think I actually was to that cloud-to-ground strike. I mean, my hair didn't stand up or anything, so I know I wasn't that close, but...
So was the sound right after the flash?
What's that?
Was the thunder, the boom, right after the flash?
It was long enough where I could actually think that it was going to be really loud, and it was really loud.
Typically, if you count the time between the flash and the thunder, every 5 seconds means it's about a mile away.
It was probably, if I was lucky, 5 seconds, if I was lucky.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So it might not have been a direct hit.
Oh, okay.
As bright as it was, I would agree with Steve. If you didn't hear that almost simultaneous crack at the moment of seeing that lightning, it might not have been a direct hit. But imagine if it had been. I mean, given your testimony as it is, unbelievable.
It was just amazing. I'll never forget that. I'm a weather spotter, and that was the coolest thing that I've ever seen.
So I'm wondering. So since you're a weather spotter, I'm wondering if it could have been negative lightning. You know, normally most lightning is positively charged, if I could use that word.
It was really neat because it was like AC current. You could actually see it pulsing.
Wow. Yeah.
It was really neat.
It's like a stinger from a yellow jacket. Wow.
It was really cool. Like I said, it's an experience that I'll never forget.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick. Thanks for calling.
Yeah,
appreciate
Drive safely.
Yeah.
And Mike in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Morning.
Morning.
I was wondering if anybody over the time has measured the size of a bolt of lightning. Or big as a thread, big as a...
The average size of a bolt of lightning is the diameter of a quarter.
I have a quarter.
Yep. So I don't know why I know that fact, but I do. I think I've been very interested in what is the average size, and a number of years ago looked it up. But I'm guessing the variability around that is probably pretty big.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a group in New Mexico that I think goes out and puts out these 15 or 20-foot metal poles whenever there's a thunderstorm coming by. Don't they measure the thickness of the bolt by how much of the sand gets fused underneath
it? Right, that's right.
They create these things. You can buy them, these little glass structures that are built as a result of lightning strikes on sandy soil.
Yeah, fugite?
Yeah, something like that, right. Yeah. Pretty awesome stuff.
And then let's say if you see it, let's say it's 2 or 3 miles long if you'd see it, how much current would it lose from one end to the other?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah,
I don't know that answer.
Hundreds of millions of volts. Isn't it huge? I mean, it's just gigantic.
It's a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't know it exactly, but it's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a heck of a lot.
It's a shocking amount.
A bolt out of the blue.
Right.
Oh, man.
We'll have to look that one up.
We can look that one up. We'll see what we can come up with. Thanks, Mike. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is the backdrop for everything we do, but sometimes it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. And when it combines with events like large-scale fires, the effects can be felt for hundreds of miles and for days on end. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. My guests today are the weather guys from UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They'll share what they know about climate and weather. And, of course, they're always happy to answer your questions when you call in. And you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page for updates and to post your comments and weather photos as well. And if you click like when you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. Taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW, where John is chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post there. And we did have some posts on Facebook. Charlene in South Grange wonders, why is there a stalled front circling Wisconsin? We're supposed to have sunny weather this last weekend, and we didn't.
I'm exactly in that same boat.
Yeah.
I was looking forward to, at the beginning of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're forecasting a really nice weekend. And yeah. then it turned.
Well, it's funny.
And I'm going to blame John because he likes these systems.
Well, no, this is great. This is really interesting weather. Absolutely right. Even on Friday, we have our weekly weather discussion in the department, and people were talking about a showery, kind of drizzly weekend, which was only the first beginning of the description of the weekend. It turned out we had a lot of rain, over 2 inches of rain in quite a number of places, and so there was a lot of precipitation that fell out of this thing. And I'm also aware, for other reasons, that the weekend was forecasted a week ago or prior to that event that it was going to be really nice.
Nice, yeah.
There was also a fairly substantial typhoon that hit southern Japan at about a week before last weekend. And as is not uncommon, these kinds of things as far away as the West Pacific Ocean can really throw forecast models off to a fairly good degree. So, you know, if you hear about a typhoon in the West Pacific, and you also hear about a 7-day forecast of any kind of weather, you might as well throw it out because it's likely that that interaction between the typhoon that's not very well observed and therefore isn't well described in these forecast models will really get in there and contaminate things. So that's probably part of the answer. Yeah. The reason why it keeps on raining is we've got this cutoff circulation sitting right over us, and it's cut off and it's cold aloft, and that makes it unstable, and it's just hard to get rid of them.
So this kind of goes along with what Nick was asking. He had a Facebook question too. What's with the storms the last couple of days coming from the southeast?
Mm-hmm.
What direction do storms usually arrive from, or does that vary?
Well, with the low pressure over us, it's going counterclockwise.
Right.
And so these storm systems are rotating counterclockwise, and it's just a little bit to the west of where we are.
And a little bit south, so at our latitude, the predominant flow is from the east, and it is unusual. What I found remarkable, yesterday we had a ball game rained out in the morning. It was amazing how so many of the parents and some of the coaches on the other team recognized that that was anomalous, that the weather was coming from east to west. And it just gives you an idea of how weather-savvy people are at their core. They really pay attention to these things.
I mean, Anne, my wife, said that this morning, too. She goes, how come that's coming out of the east?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't had my coffee yet.
Oh, well, let's move on to Diane in Stockholm, then. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Last spring, a friend and I were out, and it was a beautiful day, and there was these colorful clouds. They would be like really beautiful purple and green and pink and stuff. And there wasn't any storm clouds around or anything. It wasn't like that. I had never seen anything quite like it. And my daughter, who's in Antarctica, talks about nacreous clouds.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I wondered if that could have been one.
What time of day was this?
Yeah.
It was a beautiful day.
You know, daylight or evening?
Yeah, it was about 11 o'clock in the morning.
I wouldn't think you'd be able to see them because those nacreous clouds are really thin, and so you often see them at twilight or actually twilight's a good time.
Yeah, because they're so high, they're in the lower stratosphere, sometimes middle stratosphere, and so they keep reflecting sunlight that you can't see in any other way. Yeah.
But at 11 o'clock, the background light would be too much.
Right.
Okay.
You know what it could have been is it could have been. What do you call that? The fraction type of cloud.
Yeah,
iridescence.
That mother of pearl sort of.
Yeah, that mother of pearl type of cloud. Iridescence.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, yeah, iridescence.
Iridescence.
It's like if you look inside of a clam or an oyster and you get those bluish, magenta type colors.
Yeah. It gives you a sense of a rainbow like through a kind of crackled glass. It's not really a straightforward looking rainbow, but it's got some of the colors of a rainbow sometimes in these iridescent clouds.
Okay. Well, what are nacreous clouds? Can you explain that?
Yeah, they're clouds that form in the lower stratosphere, much higher than most other clouds in our atmosphere. And I think they are composed of water, ice, and maybe some nitric acid.
Nitric
is that
acid,
right?
Right.
Yeah, so there's a different kind of chemical makeup to those clouds, but they're solid particles as far as I understand it. And they, what you see is, as Steve pointed out, way past sunset usually, you'll see these clouds might still, maybe an hour after sunset or within the hour of sunset, you'll see these clouds still reflecting light down to the surface because they happen to reside at such a high level in the atmosphere. And they really steal the show because you can't see anything else.
Yeah, and that's about 20 miles or so, 25 miles high.
They're way up there.
So is that a portentous thing for the environment?
It's actually observed quite frequently in Antarctica, particularly during our summer, their winter, because it's so high and so cold up there that they get a lot of those.
And ironically, it's commonly observed also in Stockholm, but Sweden, not in Stockholm, Wisconsin. And people have had field campaigns to actually study the chemistry of these things. One of our colleagues has gone on these more than once, and it's always centered out of Stockholm.
Yeah.
So they're a high latitude phenomena.
So it's a good thing to study if you want to go
to
Stockholm.
Yeah, right.
There you go. Thanks, Diane. John in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello. I have a comment and a question. Comment is the truck driver from Minnesota called and about the snowstorm.
Mm. Uh-huh.
I was always told that it was 6 months after the first thunderstorm was the first frost. And there also is a date after which that first thunderstorm supposed to hit, but I can't remember what that is. There's more to it than just that.
Mm. Yeah, it's something with the temperature or something. You add it up and divide
Interesting.
By something. Yeah.
I like that better because you will get the stray thunderstorm sometime in February or March, and you probably can count on a frost once in a while in late August or early September. So that seems reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, now, yesterday, it wasn't very warm. It was nice, but it wasn't hot.
Mm-hmm.
The storms like to look to the east of us. There was a lot of thunder, hard thunder.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like there was a big storm coming in. When it's that cold, why would there be so much thunder? Because the atmosphere shouldn't have been hotter to get hard thunder like that.
So there, to get thunder, you need, as you're pointing out, some good, strong vertical motions. And one way to get that is during the hot summer days where you get the heating of the ground. Another way to get it is just to kind of reverse it. Instead of getting heating at the ground, you get cooling up above.
Yeah.
And that also makes the atmosphere very unstable so that once air starts moving vertically, it can move pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that was the story yesterday.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Yeah, it's not as common as the summertime one. There's no doubt about that, but it's the same basic ingredient, just formed in a different way.
We were in Orlando the last 4 days, actually, at Disney World. My daughter had a couple days off of school, and it rained every afternoon, and just a little, at about the same time. But then one evening, we stayed at Epcot to watch the fireworks. And the clouds were rolling in, and the lightning and thunder, and especially the lightning, you know, they're playing this music that syncs with
the fireworks.
Yeah. And it was syncing perfectly with the clouds and the lightning and the it was quite an experience.
So Disney has more control than we ever thought.
I guess so. Oh man, thanks, John. Bruce and Phelps, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Bruce.
Natty, truck driving coast to coast, I experienced some lightning in Texas a few times, sometimes sitting, sometimes driving through it. And it seemed to be pillars coming down, sometimes as big as 4 or 5 feet, sometimes as close as a few hundred feet from you. And the locals seem to call it killer lightning, and I've also heard through the industry that lightning can take out a vehicle's computer and strand you.
If lightning hits the truck or even nearby, electrical systems just go haywire. So that wouldn't surprise me.
Mm.
So when you say it looks like a pillar, so, you know, a lot of times you see lightning and it's, you know, very ragged shaped.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that? It was just a very smooth type bolt?
Well, sometimes they have some curve to it, but it comes down the ground and then sustains for a couple of seconds, not just a flash.
That's interesting. I know sometimes you get that sense, even without them being wide like you're testifying to, sometimes you see a bolt that almost blinks a couple of times, you know, and it seems like it made one strike and maybe it's making another one. I don't know if that's an optical illusion, and if you had a slow motion camera, you'd see one fairly long lasting bolt, but with our prior caller saying they sometimes pulse the energy, it's hard to know. But these lightning pillars, what's really interesting about it is, you know, you don't live there, but you drive through. But the people who do live there testifying that this is a separate kind of lightning, separate from what they usually see. That's really pretty interesting.
Yeah, and they name it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they give it a name. Yeah, that's something special.
So each time you see a bolt of lightning, that's actually composed of multiple flashes that are going back and forth between the cloud and the ground.
Yeah.
But it's happening way too fast for our eyes to see. So I'm wondering if, in Texas, if there's something associated with the cloud base altitude. Maybe it's high so that by the time a bolt occurs and hits the ground, it wants to, continually using that path to try and choose another one or something.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Yeah.
Well, they haven't had a lot of lightning in Texas recently, I don't think.
No. Yeah, they don't want the lightning. They want the rain.
Yeah, and the little they have might have started some of the fires,
too. Well, once on I-40, traveling west, coming into New Mexico, and once sitting near Laredo on I-35.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Is
So you had open country to see it.
That's the thing about West Texas, they say, is just spectacular for weather watching, is you don't get, there's no obstructions.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce.
No problem. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Very interesting. Bob in Chicago, on to you. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. A quick question. You were talking about lightning and the continuation of the conversation goes on, and someone mentioned like a bolt from the blue.
Oh, I did.
Is there a weather condition that can produce cloudless lightning strike?
Oh, good
question.
I'll
take my answer off. I'm driving.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, there is, and it's called a thunderstorm. So they can come out of almost any thunderstorm, and what they are is they kind of come out the top of the cloud instead of the bottom of the cloud. And so there's usually a thunderstorm in the vicinity, but where you are, it may be cloud-free, or it might have part of the anvil or some thin wispy cirrus up above. So that's why they often say if you can hear thunder or see thunder, then you're in, or see lightning, you don't see thunder, I guess, that you're in danger of getting hit. And again, just by the term itself, out of the blue, it's not all that common.
Yeah. And completely out of the blue is probably a bit of an exaggeration, as Steve says. It's probably a towering cumulus cloud that you can see if you looked the other way. Yeah. But nonetheless, that's enough. You know, if it's not pouring rain and the sky isn't dark and you get a lightning bolt near you, that's out of the blue.
Yeah. Because it's not raining.
Sure,
right?
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, what's going on?
Troy in Heartland, let's go to you now. Hi, Troy.
Hi, that's Troy in Hartford. But anyhow, I had two questions this afternoon. It was over 10, 12 years ago. I was listening to the AM station one night. This is like later at night. And there was a real bright flash up in the sky. And my grandma said she remembers seeing something like that too, once long, long time ago. Whatever this flash was, it actually caused interruption momentarily in AM radio reception.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, lightning, you know, we see the visible output of lightning, but they also emit a lot of radio type waves, particularly at frequencies of the FM, AM radios.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think they used to use AM radio waves to study lightning.
Yeah, to triangulate, to try and find out where they were. Yeah, that's right. And I remember as a kid, without knowing any of the details that Steve just told you, I would go to bed listening to the Red Sox games. And part of the thrill for me was, falling asleep before they lose in the late innings. and also hearing the static on the AM, because I knew there was a thunderstorm. And there was a decent chance, because most of the stations were local, that I was going to probably get that thunderstorm at my house at some point during the night. So that's a great memory of me, of mine, as a child. Wow. Is this exact kind of interruption.
So the Lightning and the Red Sox losing, those are two.
Well, of course, we've put the Red Sox losing to bed in the last decade with authority, and maybe not this year, but we've done it for the long term.
Well,
I'm satisfied.
They still have a chance.
They do.
They still have a chance.
This year. Thanks, Troy. William in Manitowoc, on to you now. Hi, William.
Hello, great show. I just had a question. Since it never rains in outer space, is the universe considered a desert? And I'll hang up, thanks.
I would say, I guess we'd have to define it as a desert and a very quiet one at that.
Yeah, there's no life in it. But I wonder if the definition of desert has something to do with something about there being land
vegetation,
or ocean surface or something like that.
Yeah, because actually big regions of the oceans are deserts.
Yeah, they're deserts, yeah. And because nothing grows there and it never rains. So pretty wild.
Where?
Southeast Pacific, right? South of the equator, I think, off of South America.
Yeah.
Is
and
one...
Bermuda is an area where, I mean, you don't get very much precipitation. That's why we go vacation there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Places 30 degrees astride of the equator.
Tend
to be pretty good places for low precipitation.
John in Fond du Lac. Your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. So on Monday the 12th, I went into the Boundary Waters. When we went in, they had told us the fire was 25 miles away to the west of us. And by the end of the day, it had run to 11 miles away from us.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. It made like a 15-mile run in one day. I remember reading that.
And the thing is, we were slogging through the marshes to get up to a lake. And just dominating the sky was this immense thunder cloud, a cumulus cloud.
Yeah.
Mushroom shape. But it was, all the colors were wrong. And,
and then
we started getting this lightning on the edges, but it was like spiderweb lightning.
Yeah.
All in the cloud.
Awesome.
And we also were getting these swirls of like heat that would go through us,
mm-hmm.
Contain smoke, and it would probably the temperature go up 30, 40 degrees, just surrounding us like dust devils.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then we were rained on with ash, but anyway, I'm just curious about these clouds. We'd heard they were called pyrocumulus.
Yeah, that's right.
We saw lightning. It was pyrostratus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one other thing, then, so that was Monday, and then Tuesday, we were enveloped in smoke all day on the lake. And then Wednesday, it hailed on us repeatedly and snowed on us all day.
Wow.
And I'm just wondering, was the hail from that fire?
That's a good question. Now, one of the reasons a fire ran 15 miles in one day is because this really pretty powerful cyclone for that time of year came rushing across the southern part of Ontario, so just to your north. And as soon as the storm and the winds associated with the storm fanned the flames, and when the storm made its slow progress to the south and east, there was a really strong cold front associated with that was going to probably deliver some kind of weather anyway, and certainly lower the temperatures enough that whatever weather was occurring might actually occur as snow in some places in far northern Minnesota. However, the pyrocumulus does a couple of things. It not only creates lots of water droplets in the atmosphere, but it also produces the very ash that was falling on you. Was some of that ash is also, as Steve mentioned earlier, cloud condensation nuclei. And the combination of producing water droplets and nuclei and having strong vertical motions, updrafts within those pyrocumulus clouds is enough perhaps to have made it go from what otherwise would have been a rain event to a hail event. It's possible.
How big was the hail?
It was pretty small, okay. Less than a pea size,
mm.
But it accumulated. I mean, well, I went with my three sons, and one of them made a hail man out of it.
Wow, amazing. You didn't save any of the stones, did you?
No, I can't. Well,
you can look and see if the ash is on
yeah,
the
side. Yeah, because you might find, I mean, I wouldn't be able to find it. You'd probably bring it to a lab where they do this kind of thing regularly, but they might be able to tell you, oh, yeah, there's ash in here at a much higher concentration than normal. So then you'd know for sure that that was related directly to the fire.
Or after the hail man melts.
Yeah.
There might be some.
Yeah, you have a pile of embers at the bottom of it, yeah. Very interesting. I saw some pictures from a news source, I forget which one, up in Minnesota, about some of these clouds, and they were unbelievable. I mean, really looked otherworldly, and your description matches what I think I might have seen.
Yeah.
But well, I wish I'd seen it live.
They were created by the updrafts of the fire?
Yeah, from the rising air and the fire, that's right.
So, yeah, if you want to get a thunderstorm to form, as we talked about that earlier, you get hot air near the ground or cold air aloft, or you get a fire, a rigorous fire. It can't be just a small fire.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A big
yeah.
fire.
So how was your trip?
Well, the trip was great until Saturday. It was a 10-day trip, but on day six, a float plane landed in front of our island, and they told us to evacuate immediately.
Wow.
Oh, because of the fire threat?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they actually shut down the wilderness, so we had to pump our way out for all day. We got in. But it was just the fact that they landed a float plane in front of our island was amazing. But,
yeah, right.
Then we had to get out all day, and we got the outfitters where there had been, like, 50, 60 cars, we were one of three left.
Wow.
Oh,
and
man.
Wow.
When we exited the forest, we had to go through several blockades.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
They were taking names and numbers, wanted to make sure everybody was there. So it was a pretty interesting experience.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Myself and my sons will remember.
Yeah, right.
That's a great trip. Yeah.
Thanks, John.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Yeah, that one you wouldn't forget.
Yeah.
Jim in Wautoma. Your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The Friday before Labor Day, there was a tremendous windstorm, Adams County, Oshera, and Points East. I was just wondering if there's any website or place that I could go to see after the fact what came through, you know, if it was straight line winds or a little tornado or what.
A lot of times the National Weather Service office is in the area, in the state. We'll have little summaries of some of these events, especially if people have called in and reported, you know, high wind event or something like that, which almost certainly happened with this one. I might try the La Crosse and Green Bay Weather Service office websites, and if you can just Google, you know, NWS Green Bay, you'll get to the Green Bay one. NWS La Crosse, you'll get to the La Crosse office, and I'll bet you'll find something there. Now, I'll caution you that the Weather Service websites are not always easy to navigate. There's no standard Weather Service website. Sometimes, I know the guy at La Crosse, he really put, and Green Bay, they put together pretty good sites. That might be a good source to find some information on that.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Phil in Westfield, hi to you. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. We're driving home from northern Wisconsin, stopped at the McDonald's in Westfield, and the question I have has to do with tornadoes and how they are formed.
Mm. All right.
Yeah, we got that question too. How do these things form?
It's a good question. It's still one that's debated. One of the things that has to, we can, you can make your point about the answer based on what the ingredients are. You need to have something called vertical wind shear, where the wind direction, let's just say the direction, but sometimes it's the direction and the speed, are different at different elevations in the atmosphere. And that sets up rotation of columns of air that are, in the first case, oriented parallel to the ground. And then if you put an updraft of a thunderstorm in a thunderstorm environment on top of that, you can start to tilt those horizontally oriented air columns into more vertical orientation. And once that begins to happen, then you've got the basic ingredients in place where rotation in a thunderstorm can really start to accelerate. And occasionally they'll drop a spout down, and there you've got your tornado. But you see how we get a little bit grayer as we go from the basic.
We know what we need.
Yeah, we know what we need, but how does the machine actually produce what you get is still a question that's being debated.
Yeah.
In 10 seconds, what's the fall and weather forecast?
The leaves will fall from the trees.
That's right. And they'll turn orange and red.
Yeah, before that happens, which means it won't be very windy before that happens.
Yeah, unless they're the real thin, short ones.
I think, actually, there's nothing unusual going on in the tropical Pacific Ocean, and so...
Normal.
It would be my first guess, yep.
Yeah. You want nice, sunny weather during the day and cold evenings.
Yeah.
Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.